MICD Chat comes to you from the National Institute for Civil Discourse, a nonpartisan center for advocacy, research, and policy based at the University of Arizona. NICD Chat is a podcast series that includes episodes about NICD programs, research, and topics related to civil discourse and politics. This is NICD Chat.
In this edition of NICD Chat, I had the opportunity to speak with Robert Talese, the W. Alton Jones Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. And we talk about his most recent book, Sustaining Democracy, What We Owe to the Other Side, published earlier this year by Oxford University Press. At the very beginning of our conversation, though, we actually also mentioned another book that he published in 2019 called Overdoing Democracy, Why We Must Put Politics in Its Place, also by Oxford. For me, there's a continuity of these two books that highlight, I think, why thinking about these political differences in some ways has become all-consuming and how we need to step back from that. But also, as he argues in Sustaining Democracy, we need to think about these as not just these absolutist kind of categories or these extremes of left and right, conservative and liberal or Democrat and Republican, but also to say, how do we think about the differences between oneself and the other, maybe not always being those extremes. And in fact, they might be with those who are a little bit closer to oneself. And Sustaining Democracy, central to the book, is an argument, what he calls the Democrat's dilemma, a small d here. And he talks about this as a tension between the moral requirement to recognize the equality of political opponents and the moral directive to pursue and promote political justice. In our far-reaching discussion about the book, Talese, I think, makes some really compelling arguments and raises, I think, some important questions that part of the sustaining of democracy is not simply our ability or the importance to engage across those differences or reach across that chasm of that extreme, but also really to look not just at those who are closer to us and kind of ideological proximity or would share a lot of values, but in fact, there's something internal. This introspection is a fascinating place to think about how we engage and live in democratic life with one another. More with Talese in just a moment. First, I want to just say thanks for joining the conversation today.
Thanks for having me, Tim. Thanks for making time.
Yeah. And so I can vividly remember, and I want to start with the overdoing democracy. I can vividly remember getting this book a few years ago, sitting on my porch, watching my kids kind of play in the yard and across the street and other places, and being struck by this kind of mixed feeling of, in one sense, as someone who studies democracy and its challenges and the opportunities that come from people communicating across differences and things like that. And your argument there was that we've, in some ways, kind of got so wrapped up into kind of the formal politics and the kind of languaging and the framing of all of this that we kind of need to step out of that. And the reason I vividly remember this is because I have deep disagreements with our neighbor philosophically, but we got along super well. And it struck me like, oh my gosh, these are the things that help us kind of navigate through somewhat of this kind of forest of democracy, right? The sense of how do we see the end of this or get through sometimes these darker moments or challenges, and why we need to kind of put some of this into its place, right? Rightfully, as you argue there, I think really beautifully, and I'd say fairly succinctly too, which is nice too. It's easy to read in that regard. And so then you kind of pick up on some of these themes in your latest book, but you also kind of make a little bit of a different argument, or at least kind of a framing to that. So I guess at the beginning here, I'd be interested, you know, for the person saying, "Gosh, these are interesting kind of things." Overdoing democracy, right? We're kind of How do we overcome some of this framing, this language? And then also, how do we think about actually the sustaining of this, right? The relationships and the like. So what's your quick version of saying the kind of the premise and the argument that one would find in sustaining democracy?
Good. So one way to start is to, by way of a contrast between the two books.
Yeah.
So Overdoing Democracy argues, this is, you know, in a nutshell, right? That there are certain essential civic capacities that we need to cultivate as citizens, which can be cultivated only in non-political contexts, only in contexts that are not already structured by partisan allegiance. And the argument of Overdoing Democracy is that more and more of our civic spaces have become saturated with partisan allegiance, with partisanship, with the categories and travails of democratic politics, that these essential kinds of capacities, the capacity to see my fellow citizens as my equals, that is not merely people who get an equal say, but are entitled to an equal say, that these the occasions for developing and cultivating and nurturing those capacities were getting few and far between, because everything was already prepackaged, coming to us prepackaged in the language of partisanship. So Overdoing Democracy argues that we sometimes need to do non-political things together.
Like what? Like, I mean, so for example, what falls into a category? Because seemingly so many things are absolutely saturated with this kind of partisan frame, and it just sets it up easy. I know where I belong or where I don't. So right. What do you argue?
So what I argue there is, because the saturation of politics is so thorough, we can't just find things to do that aren't claimed for politics. We need to construct them. And so part of the argument is, what we need to do as citizens is engage in activities with others that we believe sincerely, after some reflection, don't model or communicate or express our partisan commitments, and try them out and see what happens. So, you know, I resist the idea at the end of Overdoing Democracy that there could be sort of a list of things. I mean, it's going to vary from place to place. Right. I'll just tell a really quick story. You know, I first started working out those ideas, gave a talk to an audience of academics and non-academics, and somebody asked the question, just like you asked him, like, well, what am I supposed to do? You convinced me. Now what? And I said, in fact, I think this made its way into the book.
It did, yeah. If this is the guy who shows up with the hat or the
no, this is that's
oh yeah. I'm conflating the individuals who confront here. Yes.
Yeah. No, this is the person says, what am I supposed to do? And I said, well, why don't you volunteer to pick up garbage from, you know, the park in the center of the city? And the person looked at me very seriously and said, but that's a liberal thing to do. Mm. And, you know, I hadn't fully taken my own advice. And I just looked at the person like puzzled. I just said, it's liberal to not like junk? And moved on. But, you know, I should have sort of explored that a little bit more. And just said, well, what's liberal about it? Is it volunteering that's liberal? Is it volunteering to pick up litter that's liberal? Is it volunteering to pick up litter outside of a religious organization, like a church or a congregation? Is that the liberal thing? You know, I should have found out more about what that where that question was coming from. And I didn't. I didn't take my own advice. I automatically thought, like, oh, you're saying it's a liberal thing? Well, it must be. the Overdoing Democracy book just ends like, we've got to be a little bit experimental here, because the saturation of social space has been so thorough. We can't just find things to go and do. We've got to construct them. It's really important, though, to emphasize that the prescription is not to go and find things to do with your political foes that aren't political. So it's not, you know, invite your, you know, your partisan opponents over for ping pong or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's rather, by the way, you might do that. I'm not saying one shouldn't. But those, that kind of reach across the aisle initiative puts politics at the center, keeps politics at the center. It organizes the effort around some partisan objective, even if that objective is, you know, coming to have less hostility for the other side. The prescription at the end of Overdoing Democracy is we need to find things to do together that are cooperative and social, in which we're not suppressing our political differences. They're just irrelevant to the activity. Now, a lot of people hear that thought and say, I have no idea what you're describing. What could possibly be an activity where politics is not suppressed, but just beside the point? I couldn't imagine what that would be like. And my response to that is exactly the fact that you can't even imagine a cooperative activity in which politics isn't already playing an organizing and orchestrating role. That's a symptom of Overdoing Democracy, not the challenge. So here's the way now. Overdoing Democracy says, if we want to be good democratic citizens, we have to sometimes do things together in which politics has no place. The thesis of Sustaining Democracy is, if we want to be good democratic citizens, sometimes we have to do political things by ourselves. So let me lay.
So what in the world does that mean? Because when we, in some regard, we might think about politics in this, right? I mean, one interpretation of what you've just said would be like, okay, then that just means I vote for certain preferences, and it's this kind of, you know, aggregating of individuals, and isn't that kind of what we have, and that's part of the mess anyway? So what the world are you talking about?
Good. So it's not that.
Okay. Well, good. Clarify.
So look, you know, Sustaining Democracy, the book, emerges out of another kind of question that I would get as I was sort of giving talks to various kinds of audiences about the first book, about Overdoing Democracy. And that question went like this. A questioner would say, okay, Talese, you've convinced me. Sometimes we need to do things together that are in no way political. I'll grant it. But politics still needs to get done. And given everything you've said about polarization and partisanship and animosity and the saturation of social spaces by all of that toxic stuff, how am I supposed to do politics when it's time for politics, given the diagnostic element of the Overdoing Democracy argument? And so Sustaining Democracy is an attempt to explore an issue that I think emerges in the phenomenology of democratic citizenship, and then to try to work out a democratic response to what I call the Democrats' Dilemma.
Right.
The Democrats' Dilemma emerges from the Office of Citizenship. This is not a problem that emerges from democratic deficit or from somebody, you know, falling down on the job of democracy. It runs like this. You know, and again, we could get into, you know, why I think the following things are as I'm going to say they are.
Yeah.
But I think this is almost non-controversial, it seems to me. You know, the Office of Democratic Citizenship involves two moral directives. One is to take responsibility for politics, right? Be a participant, not a patient, right? You know, be engaged, be informed. Do what you can as a participant in a community of politically equal self-governors, right? Do what you can to advance justice. So take responsibility for politics. Again, that strikes me as, that's just part of what democracy is. It's a democracy is the aspiration for a community of self-governing equals. That means part of the job of politics falls to me, and that's in part a moral job because politics is about power and exercises of power and coercion and all the rest. So it's morally weighty. The second directive is that you have to acknowledge your responsibility to your fellow citizens. That is, in a democracy, we're not merely equals in the sight of the government and its institutions and its laws. We're one another's equals. We are sharers in the project of collective self-government among equals. And what that means is that as we are taking responsibility for politics and being engaged and active and informed, we have to enter into and maintain relations with our fellow citizens that involve consulting them, hearing their ideas, finding out what bothers them, where their priorities are, what kinds of ideas and attitudes they have about what the government should be doing. In order to pursue justice in a democracy, part of what I have to do is understand what you think the pursuit of justice is all about. So these two responsibilities, or responsibility for politics and the responsibility to our fellow citizens, sometimes pull apart. And they pull apart when the stakes are high and things seem urgent. Why? Because the directive to pursue justice looks like it advises us to dismiss those among our fellow citizens who strike us as of poor political judgment, of depraved political judgment, committed to the wrong things. When the stakes are high and the issues are urgent, the people who are on the other side of the political questions must strike me as not only wrong, but in the wrong, right? Yeah. As not only mistaken, but on the other side of the question, but on the wrong side of the question. And so it looks as if in those kinds of cases, treating my political opponents as I should, as my equals, hearing them, trying to get a grip or trying to get a sense of their concerns, feels like a concession to them. And to many of my allies will look like a concession to them. In fact, as I put it in the book, so like when the stakes are high, right? Taking steps to make sure that you acknowledge the other side looks to your allies as if you've taken a step onto the other side.
You've abandoned the principled position or the values that you say it right rather boldly, and I, you know, holding the book in hand, you can see that people listening right now can't verify this, but I've got the. In my notation, the exclamation point in the margin is the big important things, right? This dilemma that you talk about, right? The tension between the moral requirement to recognize the equality of political opponents and the moral directive to pursue and promote political justice, right? I mean, this is, and as you, at the end of that paragraph, you say like, this is this tension. So I know this is part of what you kind of spell out in this book, but like, how do you respond to that person, that person who would be kind of on your side, so to speak, to just use that language here for a moment, that would see you're stepping toward, perceivably, toward that other person who's across that chasm or however we might think about that dividing line, as not the abandonment of one's principles, of values? I mean, especially if we take seriously, like, the notions of justice, right? And I mean, I want to tether this back actually to the other book when you talk about civic friendship, because I think when you start raising some of these questions about kind of, you know, the friendship and fraternity as Rawls would talk about and others, I mean, so this is where it gets really interesting to me, because it in some ways seems to ask for one to kind of almost strip oneself back a little bit from the things that would allow you to identify yourself as a person, as a citizen, right, in that large sense, with this desire to kind of to give, how do I even want to say it? I mean, part of the challenge of articulating this is that we're not very good at doing this, right? Because we operate so deeply from this place of kind of values and convictions that the sense, as you were saying, right, it's not just about playing ping pong with the party, with the person with the other party affiliation, but it's something more than that, right?
That's right. So let me just say one very quick thing.
Yeah.
And you know this, and maybe a lot of the people who'll be listening to this know this. You know, you can read a lot of democratic theory, political science, philosophy, communication, sociology, and get the sense that from the theoretical point of view, if everyone in a democracy is doing what they should do, it's smooth sailing for democracy. And it just struck me in sort of working through these books, I'm like, that might not be true, right? There might be a kind of inherent tension in the office of democratic citizenship. What I'm calling the Democrats' dilemma is an attempt to formulate not a problem that emerges because we're not perfectly satisfying our obligations or our civic duties. This is a tension that emerges from the sincere attempt, and perhaps even the successful attempt
to
do what we should be doing. And it's just the tension between, right? Pursuing justice and treating our fellow citizens as our equals. Because when we're arguing about big things, the people on the other side look to us like they're promoting injustice.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So I think, that this is a tension that, you know, it gets mentioned, and I think it just hasn't been given enough attention, right? And I think that there's something really important about the realization, as I think it is, that we often have pretty compelling reasons to have to draw the following conclusion. The people on the other side of this issue are depraved. They've got such poor political judgment. They are so far off of the map of what a reasonable exercise of political thinking and reasoning would be like that, you know, I just should treat them like obstacles. I don't need to hear their perspectives. Their perspectives are fundamentally distorted. I don't need to try to maintain civil relations with them. I don't need to hear them out. I don't need to give them a platform. I don't need to figure out what their views are like because they're wrong. Now, I think that it behooves us. I think it does that it's good for us as democratic theorists, especially those of us who, like you and me, are really attracted to some form of deliberative democracy, right? To say, well, wait a minute, let's not dismiss that so quickly, right? Let's live with this for a little bit, because I think that recognizing that kind of argument, right? Why do I have to listen to them? They're wrong. Why do I have to extend them any kind of consult or consideration? They are agents of injustice. If they get their way, the world gets worse. So why give them anything? Why concede anything to them? From the point of view of democracy, I think that it's important to recognize that that's a compelling, seems to me, line of reasoning. I try in sustaining democracy to say it is compelling, but it's not as compelling as you might think. That is, that there are compelling reasons on the other side too. Right. And let's get a real like good weight, good weighing of the compelling reasons for sustaining democracy in the pinch. Right. Looks like the case for suspending democracy when the chips are down is really easy to make. And I think it's compelling. I just don't think it's conclusive. And so the book is trying to say, I hear the argument for suspending democratic relations with political foes. I hear it. I want to say it's got weight. I want to say it's compelling. It's just not as compelling as you're likely to think it is in the context where it's likely to strike you as most weighty. How's that? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. So actually, let's take this as a moment to take a pause, and we'll come right back to this question of like that other side of as you were just saying, right? This other side that while these might be compelling, right? I mean, even that sense of kind of the suspending of democracy, right? I mean, for all the reasons that we could kind of look around now and say, like, gosh, maybe this does make sense. Let's come back to that question.
Sure.
So today we're with Robert Talese, the W. Alton Jones Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. We are talking about his most recent book, Sustaining Democracy. And actually, I mean, I think we have to be acknowledged. We can't talk about it without talking about the other book that's closely related, Overdoing Democracy. And just before the break, we were you were talking about this sense of why the things that we kind of hold as these kind of deep convictions and feel that this is it, why it's maybe not as convincing as it might be, and I'm paraphrasing here, and so it's not exactly your language, but as convincing as it might be, maybe it's not quite as good as we think it is. Can you say more about that, or what it is on that kind of other side that we should really kind of attend to and think about as we take seriously this question of, I mean, truly, if we want to think about kind of the continuation of democratic life in this kind of deliberative form, the kind of pluralistic liberal society that, you know, all this is kind of rooted in, how do we navigate this thing? So what is it that you were alluding to just a moment ago that was kind of out there, but was not quite clearly explained?
Sure, Tim. So part of the argument, the core argument of both books, but let's now just stick with Sustaining
Democracy. I was going to say, yeah, we're talking this book. So if we just need to put that alone on the shelf, let's just let it go.
Part of the core argument of Sustaining Democracy is about the various phenomena that are called polarization. Now, you know, people talk about polarization, they lament it, you know, it's not often clear or made clear what precisely is being discussed. But, you know, just for the sake of the conversation, at least now, we can get deeper if you want, you know, let's just draw a distinction between what we might call political polarization, by which I think is the more popular idiomatic sense of the word, which is the phenomenon by which two groups in the US, we might as well call them parties, two groups sort of pull towards their ideological poles and the common ground between them drops out. The moderates sort of peel away or get expelled. And so you're left with, you know, groups that are unified around their most extreme ideological pole who can no longer find any basis for, you know, cooperation, compromise, or even productive conversation in a lot of cases. Now, political polarization is problematic for democracy when it reaches a certain degree. Maybe it's not problematic as such. I happen to think that it's not problematic as such. And it leads to, you know, log jams and frustration and indignation, a lot of distrust, so on and so forth. But that's just one phenomenon that's called polarization. There's this other that I think, you know, the philosopher in me perhaps thinks is the more interesting, puzzling, and intriguing phenomenon, because it's a cognitive phenomenon about our beliefs and attitudes and the kinds of dispositions we acquire by way of adopting beliefs, making up our minds about things. So that gives you an indication why the philosopher in me says, oh, that's where the action is, right?
Yeah.
So what I call belief polarization, this is sometimes called group polarization, but I think the word group is misleading in this case. And maybe belief isn't all that much better, but whatever. Belief polarization is a cognitive phenomenon. It's the regularity with which interaction with like-minded others transforms us into more extreme versions of ourselves. Now, extremity here means that in belief polarization, we come to adopt more extreme versions of our antecedent beliefs. We come to hold those new beliefs with greater degrees of confidence, so our credence goes up, and we become more fervent in our, what we might think of as our epistemic perspective. Now, as you know, I'm sure a lot of listeners know, this is not a cognitive phenomenon unique to politics.
Right.
Studied all over the world. You know, we've got 70 years almost of data, and it's prominent in almost any context where you have a group of people who see themselves as a group because they share some idea or belief or commitment or value in common. Doesn't matter if it's, you know, a shared belief in the, you know, injustice of capital punishment, or a shared belief that a particular celebrity is especially attractive, or even sort of, we might think of as sort of mundane and, you know, like mundane matters of fact, right? You can get belief polarization in a group of people who are all agreed that the city of Denver, Colorado is especially high above sea level, right? The more they interact with respect to their views about the elevation of Denver, the higher they think Denver is, right?
Yeah.
And they're a jury. So this is a well-documented, robust sort of social psychological, you know, finding, phenomenon, dynamic, whatever you want to call it. Now, you know, a lot of democratic theory that's interested in polarization, and there's a lot of it that is, and a lot of it is interested in mitigating it and eliminating it or reducing it and all the rest. But a lot of engagements with belief polarization from democratic theory is focused on certainly an important element or important aspect of the phenomenon, which is the way in which belief polarization fouls or spoils or undercuts democratic relations between people who are not like-minded. So if belief polarization is this phenomenon by which like-minded people become more extreme, well, as I become more extreme, more fervent, more convinced, I also, naturally enough, come to see you, the guy who's not like-minded with me, the outsider, as irrational, depraved, ignorant, distrust, you know, untrustworthy. In some studies, it looks like we are ready to attribute, like, you're not patriotic, you're lazy, you're gullible. Like, we start attributing all kinds of like nasty attitudes and traits to you simply in the virtue of the fact that I've shifted into a more extreme version of myself. So, and by the way, it strikes me as, you know, one of the serious problems for democratic theory that belief polarization raises, because in a democracy, if you want an effective voice, you have to join a chorus. And so it's not like we can have democracy without like-minded groups and coalitions and alliances. We need those.
Yeah.
But they expose us to this phenomenon that makes it harder for us to treat our political others, our political rivals, perceived people who don't share our political ideas. It makes it harder for us to treat them well.
So does this just become this kind of cyclic pattern of, right, if we want to think about kind of politics writ large in that regard of like, yeah, we find those groups, you know, the specific interests, or if they're more kind of global in scale, you know, the kind of enclave kind of intellectual spaces, even if you want to go kind of that path, do we just not keep bumping into this as a known kind of reality that, or do we do something? I mean, this is part of your argument, right? Is that yes, and then what, right? What do we do with that? You know, I don't want to use your word here, right? But here's one of those dilemmas, right? This is something that seems to just be part and parcel when we think about democratic or even civic life, right? To use that kind of larger framing.
Yeah, and so I think you're right that there's no fix or cure, right? There's only mitigation strategies. You can manage this sort of stuff.
So we're ameliorating here. We're not solving.
Good. That's a good pragmatist thought, right?
That, you know, I appreciate the nod to the kind of pragmatist, I'm using that term in the philosophical sense, not in the way that it kind of gets more generally used in a practical way.
Yeah, me too. So, but here's the thing, right? Sure, we are, you know, exposed to belief polarization simply in virtue of our attempts to be responsible citizens. A lot of the analyses of what's problematic about belief polarization is focused on the relations between opposed groups. That's fine, but that's not the full democratic impact of the phenomenon. Because, and you know, in writing the book Sustaining Democracy, it sort of struck me that this hadn't been sufficiently thematized in a lot of the polarization literature among democratic theorists. It turns out that as groups belief polarize, as their members in virtue of this phenomenon become more extreme versions of themselves, they also become more alike one another. Across a range of attitudes, dispositions, and behaviors. So you and I start shifting into more extreme versions of our, just say, opposition to the death penalty, right? Not only do we become more fervent death penalty opponents and more ready to engage in behavior on behalf of our stance with respect to the elimination of capital punishment, we start becoming more alike in other regards. And you can see why this might be the case, right? I mean, this is just sort of the toy, you know, the armchair political psychology of it. When we're both committed to something and we see one another as allies in a struggle for justice, it makes sense that we, you know, sometimes implicitly, certainly not consciously, develop modes of behavior that signal to one another that we've got each other's backs, right? That we signal our allyship to one another. And so there are these studies that show that, you know, belief polarized groups start pronouncing words in ways that are distinctive to the group. By the way, you've probably seen this study about liberals and liberals and conservatives in the United States systematically differ on how they pronounce the name of the country that's spelled I-R-A-N and I-R-A-Q, Iran or Iran. I'll leave it to the listeners to discern, you know, how that divide, but it's a pretty stark partisan divide.
Yeah.
We adopt common. You know, behaviors that might not be directly related to our stance on the death penalty, but nonetheless are ways of expressing and communicating our allyship. Now, so our more extreme selves are also more alike. Maybe that's not such a terrible thing. Here's where I think things start getting a little bit more difficult for democracy.
Okay. Please.
Our more extreme selves become more alike, and our more alike selves become more invested in being alike.
What do you mean?
We become, as you and I, in our example, we are united in a stance against the death penalty, and our allies shift into our more extreme selves, we become more alike, and we become more invested in in-group homogeneity. That is, we become more conformist as we become more extreme. Not only do we become more alike, we become more interested in being alike. Maybe for the same reasons, you know, the same sort of speculative reasons I gave earlier. It's like it becomes more and more important to signal to one another that we're allies. And so not only do we adopt behaviors and attitudes and dispositions that are more like the other members of the group's behaviors and attitudes and dispositions, we become more interested in making sure that the other members of the group also adopt those same attitudes, beliefs, and dispositions, because we want to appear to one another in ways that are very clear. We want to be able to communicate, to express our allyship with one another. And by the way, this is just, you know, if you're engaged with other people in a longer term project for political action, you need this kind of stuff, right? You need ways of figuring out who's in and who's out. You know, it doesn't have to rise to the level of a secret handshake, but it's something like that, right? It's something like that that's really important for political coalitions to do the work that they have to do to be able to make a distinction between who's in and who's with us and who's not with us. Next stage, right? Our more extreme selves become more conformist. As we become more conformist, we become more fixated on policing the border between the in-group and the out-group.
Yeah, I was going to say, so the image that's coming to mind is kind of this language, the image or the sense of boundaries and where there are kind of rigid walls, or is it kind of these, the in-betweens, right? When we think about kind of centuries ago, right? There was never a clear distinction of like, we're standing in France or we're standing in, you know, the adjacent country, but we're somewhere in between. It seems like the way that you're talking about it now, that there are elements of this that, help us clarify where we're kind of standing, but at the same time, don't necessarily want to, you're navigating this tension, right? You're clearly having some demarcation, and at the same time, it's not just about erecting these big walls. Is that?
Yeah, because we're a lot in the case that I'm interested in, right? In the case that we're discussing now, we're allied about a commitment to justice, right? And so it becomes really important, right? To see who's, to be able to keep track of who the allies are. Now, what that means is that groups start erecting more and more exacting standards of allyship. By the way, we see this happen. A couple of months ago, we saw something happen to Liz Cheney that makes no sense when you look at her voting record.
Well, yeah. I mean,
but makes really good sense when you see that, oh, wait a minute. Here's something that befalls coalitions. They become more and more invested in uniformity among allies. And so when somebody routinely expresses willingness, more than willingness, when somebody routinely expresses disagreement of a central kind with what people in the group take to be a constitutive commitment of the group, that person needs to be disciplined, either brought in line or punished.
Now, you're in, or like you're really,
or you're out. On the outs, or you're out, right? Right.
Yeah.
Now notice, you know, this is just another pretty well, documented bit of social psychology called the black sheep effect.
Right.
We hold, our attitudes towards perceived posers are more negative than our attitudes towards perceived enemies.
Yeah, right. Right?
So, we dislike fakes more than we dislike the people who we see as our foes, right? So, the thing then is, well, wait a minute, belief polarization now looks like it involves this dynamic by which our coalitions, in becoming more extreme, become more conformist, become more insisting on conformity, start expelling members. So they start shrinking because, one more bit of this, right? When you have a group that is intensely invested in its alikeness, in its being a group, when you've got a group that's really invested in its uniformity with the core of the group's commitments, the groups become less internally democratic. They become more reliant on centralized, sometimes singular, centralized standard setters and taste makers. By the way, we don't even need political theory. Like, if you've been to high school, You know how this works.
Well, yeah. So that's actually a little bit. I wasn't going to go to the high school, but like it's a good example. I mean, but this, you know, even earlier this year, a number of polls talking about, and you referenced kind of Representative Cheney here, you know, things from Gallup, for example, published earlier, right? This a very high percentage, 63% of Republicans think that a new, more conservative third party is necessary, right? This was a big jump from 54%, even in their one of their earlier polls in 2018. There was another one early from Pew that in December of 2019, partisanship remains the biggest factor in the public's political values, right? More than anything else. I mean, this kind of, again, back to that language of the kind of the real intense kind of clarity. It's the, you know, it's the language. I'm thinking about it like kind of the rhinos, right? Those kinds of caricatures that create the sense that even though overwhelmingly, right, if you are looking at someone's voting record as a member of Congress, for example, and you could very easily say this person falls here or maybe over here, depending, but yet still, if they don't absolutely kind of conform, as you were saying, to kind of a singular leader or things like that, then, you know, then they're out, right? And as we've seen, right, whether you're out on the outskirts, just inside the wall, or if you're actually over the wall and somewhere beyond, you know, that's, you know, there's some variation there, but like they both, and as you noted, right, it's probably better actually maybe be even beyond that wall rather than just pushed up against it, because that puts you in a more detrimental spot for oneself or your views.
No, that's right. And notice one other feature of what you've just described. As the group becomes more invested in its homogeneity, more interested in policing the boundary between who's in and who's out, more committed to detecting posers and expelling them, all of those initiatives, all of those projects, these endeavors become more and more central to what the group's about. The group starts becoming, right? The group starts seeing itself as the group that's invested in getting rid of the Republicans in name only. In fact, you might say that becomes the distrust, the dislike, the need to keep oneself clear of the other side becomes the defining feature of the alliance, right? And by the way, you want to see a different kind of example of how this works. Go back in your social media timeline to the night of the Met Gala and look at allies, political allies, on the Democrat, liberal, progressive, and beyond progressive side. Look at what goes on between them in their understanding of the tax the rich dress.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Now all of a sudden it becomes, right? Okay, look, we are all in favor of a progressive tax rate or making sure that more people pay their fair share or eliminating the ways in which there are illegal, you know, ways to evade tax. No, it doesn't become that, right? Once the issue now becomes, well, where do we agree? You know, left-leaning progressive versus sort of, you know, middle of the road Biden Democrat. What do we agree on? Now, all of a sudden, right, the forces, the animosity turns inward, right? Now, all of a sudden, we're not arguing about like how terrible, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is, or, you know, how awful it would be if Mitch McConnell gets his way. We're no longer united in virtue of our shared animosity and, let's just say, you know, hatred, you know, for the other side. Now it's, well, where do we stand? Forget about them. Where do we stand as allies on taxation? Or go back a little bit further, defund the police. Okay. There's a contingent of, you know, Democrat voting members of the electorate who say, Well, the police, you know, police, local police forces shouldn't have all this riot gear. That's what that means. But you also know, right? There's a contingent that means, no, there are non-policing alternatives. So we should eliminate police. And then there are more radical versions of police reform that are tied to prison abolition and criminal justice reform. There's a broad panoply of views, right, about reforming policing and criminal justice that are sites of serious disagreement over what justice requires. But those disagreements don't get engaged when the group is united around how awful the other side is. Now, it strikes me, at some point, we have to figure, at some point, the people on my side of the political divide, they've got to figure out, like, what do we mean by tax the rich and defund the police? What does that mean? And as a group becomes more and more defined by its opposition to the other side, all of the skills and the capacities to work through disagreement among allies atrophy.
Yeah.
Now, I want to say that's a problem that belief polarization gives rise to. And I want to say that's the real problem.
And so just to say it again for the person listening to this and says, wait, he just said this is the most important thing.
Belief polarization also spoils relations among allies. So let me put it this way. The Democrats' dilemma, right? Pursue justice, treat your fellow citizens as your equals. Well, wait a minute. My fellow citizens in this case, a large section of them are depraved. They're ignorant. They're not worth listening to. Why bother? Why not just go for justice after all? Why not just work with my allies, with my alliance, with my coalition, and get justice done? Any attempt to bring these other people on board or to hear them or to give them a platform just obstructs the project of getting justice done. Justice is important. Let me just go for justice and forget about anybody who's not an ally. That's, I think, a very compelling argument that Democratic citizens feel the force of. Here's the pushback.
Yeah, I was gonna say. So what's the problem if you can just get kind of people on your side and advocate for that, whatever that might be? What's
the pushback is in the absence of civil relations with your foes, the forces of belief polarization don't dissolve; they turn you against your friends.
So instead of at least how I'm hearing it, and you can tell me if this is right or wrong. So instead of us having this larger universe of disagreement of say kind of two camps here, right? I also don't want to just limit this to like the kind of Democrats and Republicans or that kind of languaging, because I think it's a little bit more kind of nuanced and beneficial to a global audience, for example, right? That don't have these kind of like the two rigid kind of categories that we do. Right. But as you're saying it, it's not so much this larger sense and we want to cut it in half, but now all of a sudden we're dealing with a half of a half or the subset. And so all of a sudden we keep minimizing, well, I don't want to say minimizing, but we're shrinking down the universe, so to speak, but in a more kind of intense sort of way. We keep repeating the larger cycle to where we've got the kind of purist view of whatever it is, one's position, the cause that's being championed, things like that. And then literally, right, no matter how microscopic it might be, it's still retaining the same kind of, is that a fair kind of take on that?
That's exactly it. Another way to put it is belief polarization shrinks our sense of acceptable disagreement.
Okay.
It transforms us into people who are so insistent on homogeneity and conformity that we see anyone who disagrees with our own view as beyond the pale.
Yeah, the other.
Worth dismissing as the other, as the other side, right? And it looks to me like, well, you want to get something done? You want to pursue justice in a democracy? You've got to grow a coalition. You've got to build a coalition. You can't let your coalition fracture. You can't let it splinter. You've got to hold people together who disagree about a whole lot. If belief polarization is a force that, in the absence of civic democratic relations with our critics, because we've dismissed them because of the Democrats' dilemma, we're just pursuing justice. So now it's just all progressives here. My disagreement with my fellow progressives is no less a disagreement about justice than my disagreement with the with my conservative members of my family. Those are also disagreements about justice. So whatever holds for my relations with, I'm just talking in my own case now, my conservative family members, the same kind of relation holds with, right, my various levels, with my allies, with people on my side of the aisle, because we don't agree about everything either. Right. And if I think that prisons ought to be abolished, and you think that, no, we just need real strict criminal justice reform and some people deserve to be incarcerated, I think you're an, I think you're on the side of injustice, just like I think.
Right? Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Right. So the Democrats' dilemma doesn't go away when you dismiss the people you presently think are your opponents, because belief polarization will give you new opponents.
Yeah, I was gonna say we just kind of cycle them in differently and in that more intense way, which is interesting because if we wanted to say like that space between them kind of shrinks, but the intensity at which you experience that space between is, it doesn't matter, right? If we hold a set of values that are overwhelmingly on the same page and we want to operate that way, but given what you've been describing, is that it still doesn't matter, right? So it could be the scenario as you outline, and this is at the beginning of this book, you know, that individual who comes up to you in the beginning of this book, right, who kind of poses this sense of, I assume who you are, right? You're this other kind of person, right? It doesn't matter. It could have been the same. Somebody else could have stepped up to you who didn't have that sense, could have aligned ideologically, even kind of categorically. It could have been a fellow philosopher, for example, at a university, and all of a sudden all the stereotypes that we would assume in those sorts of ways, and yet still could have that same experience, right? I mean, this is
exactly it. Democracy is about disagreement. And a lot of political disagreement is disagreement about what justice is all about, what it requires, what it calls us to do. Disagreements about justice are hard disagreements, but they are, that you and I are allies according to some predominant spectrum by which we chop up the political world and various, that we're allies according to that sort of terrestrial, you know, map, doesn't mean that our disagreements are no longer disagreements about justice, right? So if belief polarization shrinks our sense of what acceptable disagreement is, it stymies, it stunts our ability to engage in civil disagreement, even with people who are on the same side of some aisle that we're on. So here's the argument then. If your idea is, look, I'm going to suspend democracy with my foes so that I can better, you know, pursue justice with my friends. The argument is, here's the problem. Belief polarization is going to turn your friends into enemies. And just so that doesn't strike some of your listeners as a purely instrumental argument, right? I say this. Surely one of the upshots of your responsibility to pursue justice in the political world as best you can, surely one of the upshots of that responsibility is to do what you can to preserve the conditions under which your efforts on behalf of justice could succeed. And part of what it takes for your efforts to succeed is for you to maintain the conditions under which you can build and grow and maintain politically sound and healthy alliances. Belief polarization attacks all that, undermines all of it. So if the argument for suspending democracy is about justice, well, I've just given you a justice-based argument for sustaining it.
Yeah, yeah. Clever philosopher you are. so let's take one quick final break. And when we come back on this, I want to ask, and it's somewhat the way that you end this book, and for someone like myself, very interested. You know, you have this whole exploration of what you talk about as facilitated democracy, this whole approach that, you know, what it requires, and even kind of some of what it doesn't require. So on that back end, I guess the shortened version of what I want to pose to you is, so what? So we'll be right back with Dr. Talese, we'll try to give an answer to that question. So what do we do about this?
Good.
So today we've been speaking with Robert Talese, the W. Alton Jones Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt, author of a number of books. I've got a few on my shelf. I was trying to grab one, the How We Argue, somewhere down there. All of your work is deeply rooted in these kind of questions of how do we engage with others, kind of from the standpoint of not just like kind of the logical arguments and things, although that's kind of wrapped up in this, but it's also this bigger sense of how do we think about how we know, right? Whether we're talking about epistemology or how do we think about our relations? How do we not just kind of exist, but actually live and arguably thrive with one another, right? Given the nature, especially of the kind of intensity in which we exist right now, when we even kind of toss up the words of polarization or partisanship and the like. So there are a lot of efforts on this front. You know, NICD is one among many organizations that came into existence in the last number of years as a response largely to kind of this fracturing of life, right? Of NICD famously, after Representative Gabby Giffords was shot and a number of others in Tucson, the call was for that community to say, how do we respond to this kind of, at that moment, kind of this extreme crisis, right? And unfortunately, we kind of see these things continue to unfold and in some ways, even more intensely, depending on how you think about some of this, the moment that we are in now, even from that short time ago. So there are a number of organizations and efforts and causes that you can find, you know, across the board, the language of kind of depolarization, you know, longtime efforts in the kind of deliberative democracy space for the last number of decades that have really said, you know, here are approaches, ways that tap into, as you talk about early in this book, you know, referencing to people like Dewey and others who say we need to think about democracy's relationship to education and this needs to be lifelong. So there's a lot, right? Part of your argument at the end of this book, and there's a section that just stood out to me, that you talk about the facilitated democracy approach. And this is all within the chapter, how do we, or how can we sustain democracy? So can you say a little bit more about like what this is?
Sure. So, you know, as you were just saying, Tim, there's a very broad spectrum of, I'll say, very promising initiatives, platforms, we might even say in some cases technologies that are devoted to, in experimental or curated settings, bringing people together who might see themselves, or in fact do see themselves, as partisan rivals or opponents, And through some intervention, whether it be citizen jury kind of activity or you know, some kind of educational experience like what goes on in deliberative polling, or really just sort of initiatives that are about hearing and listening and better, you know, attending to others who you are inclined to see as your foe. These are, in some cases, highly successful initiatives that produce a lot of really encouraging data about the impact of participation in what I call facilitated democracy. I don't want to give anybody the impression that I oppose any of this. My suggestion is that it's not sufficient.
Well, yeah, so that's kind of where I wanted to take this, right? So part of why is that not why is it not sufficient?
Okay, good. For a couple of reasons, I think it's not sufficient. By the way, we're talking about a lot of different things here than not, you know, deliberative polls and citizen juries and citizen assemblies and various kinds of listen first initiatives have a lot in common, but they're not all the same. So,
radically.
In very, very broad strokes. If you want to get more, you know, detail oriented, we could, but let me just talk in broad strokes. Firstly, we want to make sure that we're not making one or two what look to me like conceptual errors when we're assessing data that come out of these initiatives. One conceptual error is to conflate the prevention of further polarization with depolarization. Now, it seems to me that if you have experimental subjects who are already deeply polarized, it might be really easy to arrest or prevent further polarization. There might just not be much more polarization in them.
so they're already so far apart that it doesn't. I mean, we're not, you know, we've staved it off, but we've already kind of had the damage done.
So depolarization and the prevention of further polarization look to me like two different kinds of thing.
Okay.
And it's not always, I'm just going to say, it's not always clear that that distinction is being properly attended to in some of the treatments of the data. Now, it might turn out, right, that on a more granular, fine-grained look at the data, that maybe this distinction really isn't so salient. But it just looks to me like conceptually important. It's connected to another kind of conceptual issue. It seems to me that there's a difference between preventing something and curing it. And so some curated or facilitated democracy models proceed on the following thought, which I think is an error, right? Here are the things that are going wrong with democracy. So if we can set up democratic experiments which force people to act how they should be acting, if we want to prevent that terrible stuff from happening, we will have helped prevent more of that terrible stuff, right? It's like saying, you know, you're really, really out of shape. Had you been running marathons every month, you wouldn't have been that out of shape. So start running marathons. That's terrible advice, right? Yeah. That's terrible advice. Or as we're seeing now, just to give you a, you know, had you taken this vaccine, had you been vaccinated, you wouldn't be on a ventilator. Giving you the vaccination now is not an option.
Right, right.
Not going to get you off the ventilator. It would have prevented you from going on it, but won't get you off. So that's another sort of like what it would take to reverse and prevent, you know, what it would take to have prevented us from being where we're at might not be a good indication of what we should do now that we're here. I think that in some of these experiments, there are also selection worries. You're getting people who are interested in doing democracy. And I worry that at least with some of the more muscular forms of intervention, where the deliberators, the subjects who are engaged, the citizens who are engaged in the intervention, are treated to lectures and information and various kinds of experts, and they have all kinds of democracy promoting experiences before they get together or before they deliberate together about the issues. And say, well, okay, maybe that does get really marvelous results in the curated context. What happens to the citizens when they go back to their neighborhoods and discover, just using my own case, that I got neighbors who don't like me because I don't wear a red baseball hat? Now what? Okay, so I just want, like, these are good contexts for building democratic capacities for sure. The some of the data that emerge, some of the findings are really encouraging, right? But what I want to suggest is fixing democracy also has a inward looking element.
Yeah.
Where it's not about learning better to listen to the other side, learning better to see the people who I despise the politics of as nonetheless, decent people, or not. It's not all about learning better to get along with others. That, here's a Deweyan thought, democracy has to do with what's on the inside of us as well. It's not intrinsically about interpersonal relations. It's about how we as individuals relate to our own political ideas. And I think that, you know, Bob Gooden has a version of this with the deliberative democracy within stuff, those who would recognize that. So I think that there's something right about that insight, although he deploys it in a way that's different from how I would. I think that sustaining democracy, the challenge to sustain democracy with your foes, is as much about you and your own sense of your political ideas as it is with, you know, treating people well and being civil and listening and letting them finish and seeing them as at least presumptively rational and all that. All that stuff is good. All that stuff is, if the data are right, cultivated by way of these facilitated democracy experiments, good. If that data all pan out, that's all good news from my perspective. But I want to say there is an element to this that's about us.
Yeah.
What is it? It's about remembering. You know, here's a Wittgensteinian thought, setting up reminders, right, to ourselves that even when our political judgment gets us to the right view, even when we've correctly discerned what justice is all about in some particular context, our political thinking can always be improved. Yeah. Now that's a hard, this is the hard edge of fallibilism for the philosophy pragmatists out there. You know, the part of fallibilism that people like, people can always be wrong. It's like, no, you can improve, right? That's fallibilism. It's the thought that even if you get it right, you can be improved. So I want to say that if the inner dysfunctions that come about by way of belief polarization have to do with the shrinking of our sense of what an acceptable range of disagreement is, so that we're now more and more inclined to think democracy can work only if everyone agrees with me, by the way, a profoundly anti-democratic attitude, right? Yeah. I want to say the way to mitigate belief polarization, in addition to any facilitated and curated activities that one might engage in designed to help ease partisan animosities and tensions. In addition to all that, we've got to work on ourselves. By the way, this is just, you know, part of what I learned from watching reality TV. It's about, you know, repairing marriages and things. It's like, well, the marriage is failing because you two can't get along. So you got to work on getting along. But part of working on getting along is you working on you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the phrase that actually guides a lot of my own scholarly work is carried by people like Eleanor Ostrom, helped advance this, Peter Levine, mm-hmm. Harry Boyd, and others. We call it civic studies, but it's framed around this question: what should you and I do as citizens? So it's this kind of collective effort. But everything you've just been describing has me now focused on the I or the me in that scenario, right? So it's not simply me stepping into this space and you stepping into this space, and then we figure out how do we work together, or how do we kind of navigate these tensions, everything that you've been kind of articulating today. But a big piece of this, and maybe arguably one of the starting points, is not so much outward, but it's really inward, right? It's yes. the sense of self as one relates to those around them. And as we were talking about before, right, whether that person is truly some extreme on if we want to use that spectrum, but it could also be that sense of self in relationship to those who have a great proximity, but yet because of this kind of belief polarization, as you've been talking about it, still set up that scenario that to use your image of the marriage, right? It doesn't have to be this wild chasm that separates them, but there's still that separation, right?
That's right.
Could be just a few of the things that are the factors that are having them sitting in a counseling session together, right? They don't have to be wildly different to have that be their situation.
That's right. Let me suggest another sort of sloganistic way of putting it, but one that might resonate with you given some of our common philosophical interests. You know, Dewey wrote this wonderful, you know, address called Democracy, The Task Before Us, which, by the way, is just one of the finest bits of democratic theory we have, full stop, right? I want to say, good, I'm on board with all that, but democracy is also a task within us, right? And it's within us individually. And this is why I want to suggest, and do suggest at the end of the book, given all of the pressures that belief polarization imposes, and given the fact that it's all up and running, right? We're now we are in a context where, you know, the calls for expressing partisan allegiance in a way that conforms with the expectations of the group, you know, being pure, being a more ardent than the next guy. All of this stuff is up and running. This is part of the political atmosphere right now. We've got to figure out a way to mitigate it, right? We can't proceed as if it weren't that way. And if we just all pretended it would go away. Can't do that, right? What we have to do is figure out a way to mitigate it. The way we mitigate it, I think, is finding moments, making time for what I call political distance. We, you know, let me put it this way. If you Google, this is what democracy looks like, instantly, hundreds of thousands of images that are all roughly the same, and you know what they are. Masses of people in a public space with signs that might not be communicating the same message, but are communicating a similar sentiment, exposing something, demanding something, calling attention to something, protesting, demonstrating against, critiquing. And by the way, that is what democracy looks like. I'm not denying that. And I'm not saying that that's bad, right? I'm saying, yeah, but although democracy needs us to be members of an active, participating citizenry, and although that sometimes means, maybe often means, getting out in the street with a sign, right? I'm on board with all of that. Even though democracy needs an active citizenry, it also needs a reflective citizenry. And the pressures or the modes of political activism, which are, again, you want to have an effective voice in a democracy, you got to join a choir. So activism puts us in relations of allyship with like-minded people. That's inevitable. That's just part of the package of democracy. Not saying that we have to figure out a way not, you know, to get around that. That's part of what democracy is. Democracy does happen in the streets. But we can't let that truth overwrite, right? Cause us to overlook that democracy also can happen in a chair. When somebody reads Thomas Hobbes and wonders, could this guy be right? So the other way to make the point is to say, as a democracy, and this connects back around to the Overdoing Democracy book, as a democracy, our political thinking, our political practice is now so tightly tethered to the divides, the categories, the boxes, the struggles, the travails of US democratic politics right here, right now, in the streets, that we've tended to give short shrift to the idea that reflection is also a vital act of citizenship. We've become accustomed to thinking that quiet reflection in relative solitude is some kind of luxury or an escape or withdrawal from politics, rather than thinking, well, wait a minute, political activity, if it's going to be democratically informed, it's got to be reflective. Yeah. It's got to involve moments of thinking your own way through the political issues. And I want to suggest, given the way belief polarization works and how deeply stewed we are in all of its forces, that reflection has to happen out of the view, out of beyond the gaze of our allies and our foes alike. We need moments of solitude so that we can reflect. One more layer to this, because I want to take it one step farther and say, we need moments of solitude to politically reflect on ideas, issues, arguments, concepts that are divorced from the present. Now, we're both college professors, and I'm sure you're familiar with, as I am, there are lots of incentives in universities now. And again, with some good reason, it seems to me, right? To try to make things relevant, right? Students, you need to meet students where they are with the things that are relevant to their life. Now, maybe that's good pedagogy in some general sense. I want to say, when it comes to teaching about politics, there's a kind of relevance that attaches to ideas and arguments and texts and thoughts and categories. There's a kind of relevance to their being untranslatable into the politics of the day.
Yeah.
That there's something democratically important for us right here, right now, to sit down in a chair and go and try to work our way through the 7 or 8 or 9 different senses of democracy that Aristotle delineates in his treatise on politics. Not because we're going to find, right, liberals think this, conservatives think that. I mean, you might find that, but that's not the point is to engage in political thinking and reflection that's not tethered to the moment is a different kind of political relevance that I think is essential to democratic citizenship. How's that?
No, I mean, you're speaking my love language, so to speak. This is the this is about you and your book, so it's not about me, but part of what led me, and I'll just speak for myself, because I think this is why I've resonated so much with your work, even in talking about overdoing democracy. You talk about civic friendship, and there's a whole orientation to this that really is importantly about how do we engage the other, right? And as we've already talked, there are so many kind of versions or iterations of that other. But more centrally, as you've been, I think, arguing here, is that there's an internal piece. And what motivated me to show up professionally and as a scholar and such is actually this relationship between contemplation and action, the sense of reflection to influence how you choose to live in the world. And, you know, the ways that you've talked about this, even as you referenced, and it's quite worthy of attention, Dewey's Creative Democracy, that task before us, the last line from that, if I could just read this, and then I think we'll probably be drawing to a close, is he says this, since it is one that can have no end till experience itself comes to an end, the task of democracy is forever that of creation of a freer and more humane experience in which all share and which all contribute. As you write it at the end of your book, you're using this language of the why and the how. I think everything you've just been saying, that there are moments for us to think about, you know, what's in front of us. Some people, David Matthews at the Kettering Foundation, would talk about this as problems in democracy and problems of democracy, right? A little bit different from the way you're framing it, but the sense of there's always the intensity of what we're staring at this moment, right? That might be lasting, it might be fleeting, who knows? But this deeper kind of question of what allows us in those kind of public spaces to engage each other are also really relevant before we even step into it, right? It's that in this internal deliberation. So the framing of public deliberation, in fact, while it's great, or deliberative democracy and the theory and the practice as the polling and other things that you were suggesting earlier are wonderful, what makes that possible and arguably more fruitful is, in fact, if you are able to think through some of these things disconnected in a positive way from that intensity of topic X, whatever it is that you are most adamantly in support or opposition of, and yet that can't be all that you frame around for all the reasons you've just said.
Yeah, that strikes me as entirely right. And let me just sort of put one more layer on that. The politics of the moment, you know, the moment is urgent, not denying that, right? This is not a don't sweat the small stuff thought, right? The present is urgent. The trouble with a politics and a sense of democratic praxis that is too tightly tethered to the present is that that kind of practice encourages us to lose sight of a future that's better. Not because we finally voted all the other guys out, we finally overcome, you know, their political ideology, and we've routed, you know, not because we've defeated them in some, you know, final way, but we've changed them. That the categories, the travails, the ways in which we conceive the political world in our democracy have shifted in virtue of our successes. Those are the thoughts, right? The politics of the present keeps us fighting with the same tools, categories, and fissures that we find ourselves with. To pick up on that Dewey, the ending Dewey, it's like that misses out on the experimentalism of the endeavor, where things change. And we've got to conduct ourselves now in ways that envision desirable changes if we want to succeed. So the idea that we can do democratic politics under the assumption that the other side is this monolithic, ever-present thing that remains invulnerable to democratic activity on my side and never changes, that's just another profoundly anti-democratic thought, right? that is encouraged in us by certain essential modes of democratic action. We need to mitigate them.
Yeah, no, I'm so appreciative of the conversation today. I think the introduction for those listening to kind of, I think the rough terrain, so to speak, there's a lot more that can be unpacked and kind of explored here in the book. So I would encourage those who are even remotely intrigued on some of these points today, this is a worthwhile one to pick up from Oxford. And so the book again is Sustaining Democracy, What We Owe to the Other Side. So it's been wonderful to spend time with you, Robert Talese, the W. Alton Jones Professor of Philosophy at Vanderbilt University. But more than that, I would say truly somebody who is trying to push us in the ways that I think importantly the conversations right now around things like polarization and partisanship and even democracy, we need to reflect on these kind of core questions about what it means, not simply in relationship to that other, but in relationship to oneself. So thank you so much for the opportunity. And
thank you, Tim. It was great to talk.
Thanks for the great work.
Thank you.
This has been NICD Chat, a podcast series from the National Institute for Civil Discourse, produced by Timothy Schaefer. If you'd like to listen to this podcast again or any of the other episodes, please look for National Institute for Civil Discourse wherever you get your podcasts. This has been NICD Chat.